money. I raised money for the college. Usually you have to go out and ask people for it. What was unique here is we met with representatives of Con Edison. They said, we want to participate in a public-private partnership, something involving STEAM. So they came to us and actually gave us $250,000 to support the renovation of this lecture hall, scholarships, internships, and the speaker series that we're doing here. It's a grant given over a five-year period. We had the big celebration last year, but I was really grateful when I reached out to Al Harris, who was representing Queens at the Queens office at Con Edison, and said, we're having this lecture, maybe just we wanted to say a few words on behalf of Con Edison.
Yes, sir. I'll just take a brief moment to, first of all, thank you for the work that you're doing, your studies. See, at Con Edison, we invest in our system, our infrastructure. We also invest in our communities that we serve. What better place right here in Queens than Queens College? As we do our research and our development to find better ways to serve our customers more efficiently, with clean energy and with reliability, we also look at the communities and the people who are in the communities that are actually receiving our service. So we're proud to be a supporter of Queens College that has so much to offer and has done so much already in the community. And I just want to encourage you to keep moving forward, keep finding, doing your research, doing your studies, and maybe even considering Con Edison when you're done to help make not only our borough a better place, our city, our country, and even this world so much better for the future and future generations. So with that said, thank you for all that you do. Continue to do well.
Great pleasure to introduce Michael Lubell. He's the Zanatsky Professor of Physics at City College. He went to high school at Radcliffe Hall with Columbia College. Graduated with a PhD in physics, in particle physics from Yale, and looked at a wide array of problems, including the spin structure of protons and paradigm conservation. And this work was done after Yale at the Stanford Linear Accelerator, at the MIT-based laboratory at Brookhaven, and at Berkeley Accelerator. He's been at City College since 1983, took out 7 years there to serve as chair and did quite a lot of work to build up the department. And until very recently, he was for 20 years the director of public affairs of the American Physical Society, and there he handled all interactions of the physics community with government, and in fact was the first person to lobby government on behalf of science. And he worked there especially hard on developing energy policies, and he's written many opinion pieces about the role of science in society. And he's written a book about this, Navigating the Maze, How Science and Technology Policies Affect America and the World. And you may be particularly interested to hear what he had to say, because he said, he told me this morning that before he wrote the book, a very large fraction of the book tell about things that he only discovered in writing the book. So, that's remarkable.
Pleasure to be here, and I assume you can all hear me. I'll just say a couple words about the book and how this all materialized. I was approached by a few publishers who said, you know, there is no book that has existed in the area of science and technology policy. And I said, well, actually there is a book, but it's not a very good one. I tried to use it in a seminar when I was teaching, and I couldn't get the students to read, and that told me it was not particularly good. It's also out of date. So I said, well, let me take this project on. And I don't know how many of you have written books, but the typical thing is you do a sort of a book proposal, like even if the publisher approaches you, you write the so I did that. And then as I had, when I started to work on it, I set, also set a goal to get this thing completely written in 9 months. And I had, if you haven't written a book, I tell you how to do that. It's possible, and I do. Well, my wife says, if you write another one, go find somebody else to live with. But this is a fairly, in some senses, a fairly dry subject, and I would try to give you pointers on it. In the course of that year when I started to work on the book, I one of the people I knew was Walter Isaacson. I don't know if you know the name. Walter had written many biographies, among them Steve Jobs, Einstein, Da Vinci is the latest one. And I was telling Walter about the project, and he said to me, let me give you a piece of advice. He said, tell stories. People don't remember facts, they remember stories. I said, okay, that sounds like a really good recommendation. So I went back to the publisher, and I said, I'm changing the approach with your permission. So the editor, a couple editors, looked at this thing and said, go ahead and write it. And so the book, which is called Navigating the Maze, How Science and Technology Policies Shape American World, is essentially a historical narrative. And what it tries to do is to show you the complexities of policy making, how it affects science and technology, and how we have come to be where we are today. It's, and we'll go through this. I'll show you what I'm going to talk about today. We'll go through the things you know that. First of all, what do we mean by science and technology policy? Some way to visualize why do I call it a maze, and then stories from the past to illustrate all the points. Something about policy today, the modern era, and what we are facing in terms of challenges. Where are we going? What does the future look like? So, let me start with the issue of what we mean. It's actually a dual phrase, dual use phrase. Why do I say that? Well, what we mean by it, on one hand, is the corpus of science and technology, knowledge that we have, that we use to develop public policy. That's the one hand. The other part of it is that public policy affects tremendously what we actually do in science and technology, and how we advance things. So both of these things have to be in our part of this whole story. Why do I call it a maze? Well, my visual image is the Los Angeles freeway system. Presumably a number of you have been out maybe seeing stuff like this. And what I imagine then are the individual highways basically representing the various facets of science and technology. And I'm using the word science and technology very broadly. So we can talk about research and development, or advanced research. So that would be one item. Then we have applications of various things. It could be environmental, could be defense. Then you have another one, because science and technology affect our lives in so many different ways. So there's the health piece of it. There's also economics. And so all of these highways, which are carrying the information in those general areas, and by the way, also one that's new discovery, and they intersect. And so where those intersections take place, showing that one particular area affects another. Then there is, so what's on the highway? Well, there are the drivers, and they are paying. They're engaged in doing science, doing research. They're engaged in what I started, this whole cottage industry of science lobbying. They are policymakers. They're elected officials. So all these were the drivers And then the vehicles that they use depend upon what they do. If you're working in a laboratory, it means you have laboratory equipment. So you are using that vehicle. If you're a member of Congress, then your vehicle is going to be the sort of thing that you do in your daily work, which means you have a staff and you also study. So that's the complex. It's very complicated. And if I try to give you a primer on how to do things, your eyes will glaze over. So rather than that, I'm going to do a story. And this is sort of the broad outline. Starting back in 1787, see, you don't have to see, look at all these pieces right now. But we'll sort of add, by the way, I can only tell you a very small number of stories. The book has a lot of them. We don't have time for it. So, as I do this, I want you to keep in mind a few words. Number one, war. Number two, disease. Number three, serendipity. Number four, personal relationships. Economics, these are the five. There are also words that have come into the lexicon more recently, and I won't be saying too much about any of them, but just to have it here, robotics, artificial intelligence, globalization, competitiveness, gender equity, and social justice. So if you're talking to people about public policy today, these are other things that come into play, and I'll touch on some. Let's talk about the early days. I'm starting 1787, the Constitution. I want to show you something very interesting from that period. This is the first coin of the realm. George Washington, we have to have currency, we have to have coins. National, not state. That's the back of the coin. You see this is 1792. How many of you know what the motto is on coin, on our currency? Anything else? In God we trust. Let me show you what the first motto was, 1792. Probably surprised. Liberty, parent of science and industry. So if you go back to the founders, what you find is that they had a tremendous interest in science. Washington, of course, Franklin, everybody recognizes as probably the first American scientist. Thomas Jefferson. Adams. Was actually a member of the American Philosophical Society, which is where science is complicated. And you can go through the list. So from the very founding of the country, science was front and center. What's interesting is that the Constitution doesn't deal with it very much. And part of the reason is that the people I just mentioned to you were regarded as the elitists. And there was a pushback from the populace. And so you find in the Constitution scant reference to science, except insofar as patents are concerned. But that is not what the people who were the elitists wanted. They lost that. All right. So, how many of you recognize this building? Smithsonian. Known as the castle. They say, if you go to Washington and you ask somebody on the street, or a policeman or whatever, guy, where's the castle, they almost always know what you're talking about. Now, the Smithsonian Institution has a very interesting history. How did it come to pass? James Smithson was a chemist and a fellow of the Royal Society in England. He had never been to the United States. And he was on his getting a little bit older. He knew that he was going to be dying soon. And in his will, he bequeathed money to the United States. Well, his nephew had to die first. say would be transferred for the increase and diffusion of knowledge among men. What do you do? What does it mean? Nobody knew, but the money shows up. Hungerford dies, his nephew dies in 1833, 105,000 pounds deposited in the United States Treasury in 1838. There was some litigation that was going on. That's why that took the lawyers out of law, solicitors, whatever. But this is all it said. They figured 25,000 pounds actually quite a bit of money back then. What does Congress do? Not until 1846 they established the Smithsonian Institution, but without much guidance. The only thing they did is to install Joseph Henry, who was at that point one of the most prominent American physicists, and made him the secretary of the institution. If you go back and you look at the requirements that they put in place for choosing the secretary, it reads as though you're selecting the director of the National Science Foundation. So, in fact, probably when the NSF was created, and I'll have a few words to say about that later on, if you look back, they saw this, the description is entirely appropriate. All right. So now the question is, now you have an institution, it's got some money, what do you do with it? It intersects another interesting story. I don't know whether any of you can recognize the figure in the upper on the slide. That's Edmund Hay of Cobb. So he was known for his work in astronomy and physics. But he was a bit of a crackpot. He believed that the Earth was hollow, made up of concentric metal spheres. That was a picture he drew, four shells. Okay, that's back in the 18th century. Nothing much happens. People admired him for his astronomical work. Nobody paid any attention to his hollow Earth theory, which was a bit of a crackpot theory. Then along comes a fellow by the name of John Simms, who was a captain in the U.S. Army, not a scientist, but boy was he connected politically. He was the son-in-law of William Henry Harrison, the president, and Simms thought Halley had it almost right. What did I mean by almost right? Halley said four shells, Simms said no, there are five, and oh, by the way, if you go to either the North Pole or the South Pole, you can find the entrance. So, what did he do? He joined his political connections, and he sold Congress a bill of goods. And Congress appropriated what would amount to about $10 million today to mount an expedition to find the entrance to the hollow Earth. Think about it. It's not a scientist, it's somebody who had connections. Well, Simms died, but the expedition went off as planned. It was Charles Willis was the person who actually conducted this thing. 4 years, they went around the world, continent to continent, never reaching either pole. They came back. They brought back no entrance to the hollow Earth, but they brought back a trove of scientific artifacts. What to do with it? Well, there's the Smithsonian. So what they brought back wound up in the collection of the Smithsonian, which is looking for things. So I'm showing you here that the political connections are important. There's a certain degree of serendipity in terms of how things happen. This is the history of the Smithsonian. Now, we'll skip forward to the Civil War. Most of you are familiar with